It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We look at the margin of profitability in agriculture and how high prices for crops, but also high input costs, affect Wisconsin farming operations. Net farm income is on track for a nearly 50-year high, according to estimates from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Join in on farming in these times, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Mitchell is a professor at UW-Madison in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
We saw the record 40-year high inflation in the broader economy last year. What has the past 12 months meant financially for farming operations?
It's been, from a financial perspective, a very good year. 2022 is projected, as you said, a record farm income. We haven't seen this in a long time. You correct for inflation, there's a little bit back in the 70s, it was the same. So this is a very good year.
I wonder, I mean, as you say there, the farm income could reach the highest level since 73, adjusted for inflation, of course, through the decades. What is driving the profit boom?
It's mostly been just higher prices. We've got nationally, we've had really good corn and soybean prices. Those are our major crops. We grow, a third of the world's corn, a third of the world's soybeans, and those have been exported a lot, and we've just been getting good prices. At the same time, livestock revenues are up. Dairy has had a really good year in terms of prices and revenue coming in. The same with cattle and broilers, chickens. It's the way farmers like to make money, from selling things at much higher prices than you cost relative to your cost of production.
Are there pockets, though? Are there winners in this, or are you seeing these effects across the board for farmers?
There's always variation, of course. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, fruits and nuts and vegetables, and some of those, cotton hasn't had, those crops have not had a stellar year relative to, as an aggregate group, relative to our major crops, corn and soybeans, and things like cattle and calves and dairy products, those and broilers. Those have been really good years, but those are also a large part of our ag economy in terms of dollars. And so the big chunks of our economy and the ag stock sector have had a really good year.
The USDA reports show that federal government checks accounted for nearly 40% of a farmer's income back in 2020. And since then, the rate of government payments issued has been declining. What has that meant for farm cash flow?
Essentially, we had record payments back there during the pandemic. There's a couple, and that has definitely increased their cash flow. And this is all at the typical or the average. There's always individuals varying around this. But with all that government money at the same time coming in as the prices for commodities started to recover, we had a tremendous amount of cash flow. It really, first thing farmers did is rebalance their balance sheets, get their mortgage payments paid down. We were on the edge of a farm crisis, to be frank, within margins and debt running up relative to income. And the first thing they did is rectify, get their whole financial situation under control. So we've seen a major improvement in the farm lending, rates of delinquency, farm bankruptcies are down. Then you move into things like, okay, now what do we do with this money after we've done some of that? We've seen, land purchases, we've seen machinery being repurchased, because like I said, we were on the verge of a crisis happening just before COVID was hitting. Then when COVID hit, so farmers have been enjoying the chance to recover some of these things they've avoided doing for a few years of having very low farm income.
That's what I was curious about. Like, in a more profitable year or a couple years in the farm business, where do operations put that money? Like, is it replacing equipment or buying land or paying down debt? What is a typical approach in a boom time?
Well, a lot of times you like to get your debt paid down so you can rebuild your equity and improve some of that so that when there bad times come, always, just like good times come, there's bad times too. And you got to get your situation prepared for that. We had those low interest rates at the same time as lots of cash. And so there was farmers taking on additional land purchases, lots of rebuilding, improvements to facilities. And then machinery. There was a shortage of machinery for a while there, because farmers were really excited about recovering some of these, reinvesting in machinery that they needed to get replaced or updated.
But I've been reading about how land prices are going up so much higher as well at the same time.
Yeah, that was part of it. And you had this lots of cash and a positive economic outlook. There was a lot of people looking to invest in farmland, not just farmers, but we've had, I think last year, the numbers show a 14% increase in the land values in Wisconsin, according to USDA, back in August. Federal Reserve Bank has good farmland up even more in the region. So yeah, we've had a good jump and that helps farmers' balance sheets as well, because now your equity's gone up.
Talking with Paul Mitchell about Wisconsin's farm economy and what he sees, professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. You can join in about your farm operations and how you're approaching these times. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul, how do farmers feel about the state of commodity prices? What do you hear out there?
Well, there's a lot of, I would say, they like high prices, obviously, but there's just a lot of worry about will these last? There's just so much market uncertainty with the war in Ukraine. What's going on with China in terms of this whole there's a lot of political instability, but with China, it's the their COVID response. Is it going to trigger now that they seem to have kind of gotten rid of the zero COVID policy and they had a lot of COVID hit? Is that going to slow down their economy? Because China is such a major player in terms of ag import, their imports are exports, and that it's just a concern if their economy slows down. And so they like high prices, but there's just a anxiety out there. And then between the will these prices hold, and then just the cost of all up and everything. And so they're anxious about these are great prices, but am I really making money? It's so hard to figure this out now because I seem to be paying so much for everything too.
The steep price increases that we've seen at the grocery store for our food costs. I wonder if growers are able to get more for their commodities, more for their livestock. I mean, is the money that we're paying so much more in groceries finding its way back to producers?
Well, on average across all your food products, the average is something like 17-18% of the food dollars for the farmer. Most of the cost of the food, what you're buying in the grocery store, is for everybody else along the supply chain. The farmer on average gets less than 20%. And there are certain, each items vary. Milk is, the more processing or people that touch the milk or whatever product you get at the market, the greater the farmer's share, but still. These higher prices for farmers, it's the food prices are part of it. Reverse that. The higher prices for food, some of that's for the farmers, but a lot of that's for the whole supply chain along there and all the extra labor costs and just the supply chain disruptions we've heard so much about.
UW-Madison ag economist Paul Mitchell with us on farm earnings in our state at a time when there's uncertainty in the broader economy. Cullen, about your crops, your livestock, your workforce, your balance sheets on the farm, informing your decisions on where to go next with your operations. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss farmers grappling with higher costs for feed, fertilizer, machinery, while commodity prices boom and our broader economy experiences 40-year high inflation. Bring your personal experience on farming and what your operation has done over the years to weather these ups and downs, these changes. 800-642-1234. We have farm economist Paul Mitchell, UW-Madison professor, stays with us. Paul, digging more into that USDA profit data, estimated dairy farms would see the largest growth in average net cash farm income in 2022. Why is dairy flush?
Well, you've stretched me there. I'm really a dairy economist, but there's just exports and getting some of these supply chains. It's always that's an important part of all these big commodities. We're a net exporter, and so the ability to move stuff overseas, export it, is what keeps the prices high. When something slows down exports, it tends to lower our prices at the farm gate here in the U.S. And so dairy has had I'm guessing, a good export market. I'm sure it's facing headwinds now as the dollar's gotten stronger, so that'll tend to slow down some of our dairy prices.
You mentioned just briefly bankruptcies. It wasn't too long ago where Western Wisconsin led the nation in farm bankruptcies. What are you seeing now?
I actually looked those numbers up again, and we're not number one anymore, which is a good figure not to be to be losing on. The farm bankruptcies, the Chapter 12 filings, those data are available online. And I looked this up. We have 10 in the state active over the last year. So that's a good sign. We're slowing down. It's been a long decline here. I'm not so sure how much some of that is the fact that the court system, some of the federal government, the Farm Service Agency that does have some ag lending, has sort of had a moratorium on farm bankruptcy filings. And so I think some of that might be more of a policy response than an actual financial response, but I'm thinking it's a mixture of both. Good prices for a lot of these commodities and slowing down of pushing some of these bankruptcies through the system up to the USDA's Farm Service Agency.
Let's take a call now. David in Cumberland is with us. David, hi. What is your situation?
Hi. We have about 70, 80 milk cows and the ranges for milk, and then we have about 150 to 250 sheep that my sister owns that we use for meat. And the price has been really good. But even that, the cost has been so high, especially finding labor. I have five guys who help me. I have an Amish guy who's in his 26, and then I have four others, but the youngest is 65.
The youngest is 65. So really, workforce challenges are an issue with you, David. What about the prices for milk and sheep? What are you seeing there?
The price is really high, but my input costs are about twice what they were 3 years ago.
Twice as they were. Okay. So what are the trade-offs there then, David? What do you have to do with your operations when you have tight labor issues, you've got all these input costs, but you are seeing higher prices on the sheep and the dairy?
They do help, but both my sister and I work off the farm because we both have degrees. My sister works at a dairy plant as a lab tech, and I work as a teacher. So I teach agriculture in the morning, all day long, and shop classes.
That is one busy day. David, thank you for sharing your situation. Paul, what do you see there? 70 to 80 milk cows, 150 to 250 sheep for meat, and multiple jobs going on.
That's right there is a very typical situation. So many farmers that are classified as farmers by USDA have other jobs as well. And it's just a reality of farming there's a lot of people that are, think of them as part-time or evening farmers, because it's a stabler income if you've got another outside source. It's a part of diversifying your portfolio. His size in terms of dairy is up well below average now. We've just crossed the average dairy herd in the state is over 200 cows now. And what I'd say, that's a very typical dairy farmer in terms of numbers.
What trends do you see as far as farmers retiring or passing the family business to relatives versus selling off land for developers?
Yeah, I'm looking at the data here. This is the national numbers, but 42% have off-farm jobs, and 18% of farms in the country are retirement farms. And so that right there shows you how typical that situation is. And so exactly, they are looking for ways to extricate themselves from the business, the day-to-day grind of farming, and moving into the retirement or having that other off-farm job just to protect themselves from the fluctuations in prices and income. So I think what we're seeing is this baby boomers are definitely moving out of farming, and it's always hard to, as people get older, they can't physically work as much, and finding labor, young people, we just have fewer of them, and agriculture for a lot of them is not the attractive business in terms of that day-to-day grind of being a farmer.
That's what I wonder. Do young people have the desire for this career path, but also the capital for the upstart costs of starting a farm operation if it's not, a family business that is being passed down to you, for instance?
Oh, definitely. You know, especially it was easier when the interest rates were low, but now we've got high interest rates. That's going to slow that entry into the industry from outside places. There are paths to it with, you know, apprenticeship programs, and there's special loan programs the USDA has for beginning farmers. But it's still, you start small. You got to grow a business. You can't, you know, you're not going to compete with the big operations for years. It just takes time and a lot of hard work.
Talking about Wisconsin's farm economy with UW-Madison's Paul Mitchell, professor in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. Join in on your farm operation, what you see in your farming community, 800-642-1234. David mentioned workforce, and the State Department of Workforce Development says Wisconsin is one of a few states with laws protecting migrant farm workers, and the department says the state employs 5,000 migrant workers yearly. How important are migrant workers to the agriculture farm equation and the industry here in Wisconsin?
They're very important for the dairy industry, but I got to get this clear. Dairy doesn't have migrants as much because they have, you know, full-time jobs that are permanent all year long. But a lot of our fruit and vegetables industry are they have seasonal demand. So like in the harvest time for potatoes, for example, or some of the fruit, the cranberries, another good example. And there's a lot of processing vegetables in the state. So having a migrant labor force to work either on the farms or in the food processing facilities, people may don't realize this, but we have the second largest processing vegetable industry, the industry that takes a raw vegetable and puts it in a can or freezes it. We're second after California. California's got a large tomato, making tomato sauce and paste. We have a large green beans, sweet corn, green peas, and a lot of those other vegetables that we put into cans or freeze, as well as a large fresh potato industry, making potato chips with them as well. And then just other fruits and vegetables that's so important, and it's seasonal demand. Hmm. Someone's got to move them around. Someone's got to work in the facility, and migrant labor is crucial for those industries.
When you talk with Wisconsin farmers, what reforms do they want to see happen to the farm workers visa program to help solve some of these workforce challenges?
I've never heard them say anything specific in terms of what legal changes, but it's always a continuing issue is labor demand, having people to do these jobs. They can't find people. And to be frank, I don't know how many of them really understand all these visa things and what an H-2A visa is and such. I do know in the dairy industry, I've got a former student that basically started, he's from a dairy operation, but he started a company that essentially goes to different places and recruits workers through family connections to his spouse. And so he's made a business, part of his business, out of bringing in ag labor from other places in the world. And I think that just gives you a sense of how big a demand there is. There's just so much need for farm labor, both migrant and non-migrant.
Before we have to let you go, I want to ask you about the farm bill. Pick your brain there as it's set to expire this year. The package of legislation covers so many different aspects of agricultural policies. What should we be watching for with the farm bill, and what economic factors might have an impact?
I think it's not going to be a revolutionary bill in the sense they're not going to roll out some really big new programs. In terms of commodity support anyway, there's not going to be a big change in the crop insurance or a big change in the subsidy programs, the dairy one and the ARC and PLC. These programs, they seem to be working. Farmers are generally happy with these programs. The big push the Biden administration has indicated, and I'm curious what Congress will think, has been towards conservation programs. They've been flat funded for years. Inflation Reduction Act passed this fall, and then the USDA started these climate smart partnerships for commodities. And those have poured billions of dollars into reinvigorating our traditional conservation programs. The commodity support, the climate smart ones are some new ideas. So I'm actually curious to see what Congress thinks. Are they going to continue this push towards conservation programs? Because we'll see. I tend to be in the middle. I don't worry, choose parties and such, but from an intellectual perspective, I'm very curious what this conservation stuff is going to do, because we've been flat funded, and you can see that in the environmental response variables like soil erosion. It's been flat. We haven't improved in a long time, and it's because we haven't paid for anything.
Paul, thank you for joining us in the analysis.
You're welcome.
Paul Mitchell is a professor at UW-Madison in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. He's director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about one of Wisconsin community's iconic creatures.
Trolls are everywhere you look in the Dane County village of Mount Horeb. Troll cartoons on the street signs, troll footprints on the sidewalk, sculptures of trolls lining Main Street. The sheer number of trolls in the community prompted a Wisconsin listener to ask, what's the deal with all the trolls? WPR's Tim Peterson went to find the answer.
Over the years, Leah Jaber has frequented a Mount Horeb tea shop with her family. During each visit, the trolls always got the attention of the Madison East High School senior. You know, trolls, those ugly and dim-witted, yet powerful ancient figures from Norway's pagan past. To satisfy her curiosity, Jaber reached out to WPR's Wisconsin.
The biggest thing that got me curious is basically just seeing all the trolls, but having no idea where they came from or what they represent or what they mean.
I invited Jaber to join me to find the answer in Mount Horeb, officially trademarked the troll capital of the world. We meet at the Mount Horeb Area Historical Society, where Destiny Udelhoven is the director. She says they get asked about the trolls constantly.
What's the deal with the trolls? That's like exactly how they ask it.
Udelhoven says the abundance of trolls harkens back to the area's Norwegian heritage and a marketing push to attract visitors.
I think that's what I want people to see as a historian, is that the trolls didn't spring out of nowhere. We didn't pick them because they were just the most marketable thing. You know, they really have a strong, deep connection to our history here.
That connection being two major waves of Norwegian immigrants to the Mount Horeb area in the mid and late 19th century. Mount Horeb is known for its lasting Norwegian culture, a living museum outside of town with Norwegian-style buildings, annual Norwegian musical performances, and a water tower covered in rosemaling, a stylized Norwegian floral painting. In the 80s, a Mount Horeb resident was also crafting two-dimensional birch bark trolls. Jaber saw these up close at the Historical Society.
So you can walk down this little crevice and you can see, you can be surrounded by the trollness of them. Go ahead, you're the one who asked. Yes. Go down there, experience it.
They're definitely different than the carved trolls because they're painted kind of realistically. So yeah, I guess I'm a tiny bit scared, but I think it's kind of like joyous energy, I guess.
The carved trolls, the ones you may have seen lining Main Street, the chicken thief, the mayor. Local artist Mike Feeney did most of them.
I kind of get a kick out of them because they're humorous. They're a little bit off-center. Trolls really are not like the kind of cuddly things that you want to bring home. The Norwegian trolls are mean and nasty. They'll poison your well. They'll burn your crops. But the Mount Horeb ones are more like the New World trolls, a little happier, a little more jovial, and a little bit off-kilter.
Feeney was commissioned by the village in the 1980s to solve a marketing problem. That's according to Jim Leary, professor emeritus of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's also a longtime resident of Mount Horeb.
In the 70s, folks in Mount Horeb were realizing that the construction of the 18-151 bypass would route traffic away from their town, and how could they get people to come in? And so there was a meeting of minds about what kind of theme to emphasize, and they did surveys, and Norwegianness seemed to be something that they could ballyhoo a little bit.
Not everyone in the village loved the trolls right away, and Feeney says some came around when they started getting results.
They kind of fought for their existence, the trolls did, and then the people behind them really enjoyed them, and then apparently they brought a lot of people coming to town, taking their picture in front of the troll.
And while the trolls aren't for everyone, many locals will tell you they're lucky. And in this village, trolls are the protectors of the residents, the businesses, and nature.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story on Mount Horeb's trolls. And that story idea came to us from an audience question as part of WPR's Wisconsin. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Census Bureau has redefined the meaning of an urban area. Millions of Americans who live in small cities, towns, and villages lost their urban designation and moved to the rural category. Call in with your questions about this change. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jerry Deshane is Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Jerry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, Kate. Although I do have to say, really, we're going to talk about statistics after that story on trolls? I don't know. The juxtaposition really makes me uncomfortable.
Jerry, we're open to all ideas. So,
we're going to say a troll did this one.
Oh my goodness, we digress. Okay, so the Census Bureau's new definition means more than 1,100 urban areas are now considered rural. How big of a deal is this change for places that have been redefined?
The scary, truthful answer, Kate, is we don't know yet. Our concern all along with this change, which, by the way, affects about somewhere around 40 Wisconsin cities and villages, the simple fact is this could either be a drag on their ability to attract economic development and, you know, new growth. It could be a drag on their ability to compete for state and federal grants, or it maybe could have no effect at all. Unfortunately, we don't know and we won't know which of those is the case until we're into this for a few years.
Any thoughts on why the Census Bureau made the change in definition to what's an urban area?
The Census Bureau has been under pressure from data analysts and statisticians for several decades. They use 2,500 as the dividing line. If your community has a population of 2,500 or under, you are considered rural. If it was 2,501 or higher, you were considered urban. And data analysts, for reasons that I guess I really don't know, thought that the number should be up around 5,000. So there's that group of communities between 2,500 and 5,000. We're talking about places like Oconto or Omro or Waupaca, Pulaski, places like that. Not Waupaca, but Pulaski. Sort of those middle-sized cities and villages in Wisconsin. Are the ones that, you know, they woke up in the morning, thought they were living in the big city, but by the evening they realized they were back home on the farm. So it's a statistical move only. There really hasn't been a shift to rural in Wisconsin. The Census Bureau will say it's a better way to count and to consider what's rural, what's urban. I have to be honest with you, if you went and stood on a street corner in Omro and asked most people, they would either look at you with a blank stare or say, well, we've been rural forever anyway. I don't think people on the ground are going to care. It only comes home to roost when it comes down to, like I said, economic development. And perhaps competition for grant funding.
The Associated Press was reporting that the change could affect federal funding. You just mentioned grants, like, you know, federal funding for healthcare, transportation, education, other services. What effects could it have, though, in terms monetarily on communities?
Well, and this is what's been frustrating about this, Kate. The League submitted a letter to the Census Bureau last March when this was being considered, because the Census Bureau came right out and said, we are not going to look at the impact of this on other federal agencies and programs. They essentially washed their hands of that and said, that's not our problem. That's not our responsibility. And there's just simply no clearinghouse where you can go there and say, okay, if this community goes from rural to urban, what does that mean? What can't they compete for? Or are they creating more competition for other smaller communities? That information simply doesn't exist. We hope the Wisconsin Department of Transportation would have a clear answer on some of their road grant programs, but they just don't. What's going to happen now is over the next couple of years, state and federal agencies will either perceive a problem or they won't perceive a problem in who's able to compete for grants and who's not.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's a little obscure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
One thing that jumped out at me in the changes is that for the first time, the Census Bureau adding housing units to the definition of an urban area. And, you know, we've been talking on our show with mayors a bunch in recent months. So many Wisconsin communities have housing stock issues, not enough workforce housing in particular. Is that concerning as you see the census shift?
I'll get into why it's concerning, but it's a secondary effect.
Uh-huh.
Whether they use housing units or actual bodies as the count, in a place like Wisconsin, where frankly we have a lot of second homes, it's actually somewhat beneficial.
Oh.
Because what they're saying is it's either 5,000 population or 2,000 housing units within a given area. You know, they didn't used to count housing units. So now that will help somewhat get a more accurate account of what's going on in that community. But Kate, one of the concerns, economic development experts often tell us that when a company is looking to relocate to an area, they only look at what are called metropolitan service areas. And those are not rural areas. Those are urban areas. And in Wisconsin, we've just taken 40 cities and villages off that list. Now, will that really have an effect on Mazomanie? Don't know. Just simply don't know.
Jerry DeShane leads the League of Wisconsin Municipalities as we look at challenges facing urban and rural communities, including population change and access to government funding. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, any point in our conversation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into how Wisconsin local governments are operating after the U.S. Census Bureau redefines urban and rural communities. Join our conversation about the budget situation, the impacts to delivering basic services. Your questions welcome, 800-642-1234. Jerry DeShane is Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities and stays with us. Let's take a call now. Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Since this is just really a statistical thing, could not the Census Bureau have just created like a semi-rural category to account for these mid-range towns? And can something be done at the state level for these municipalities, branding, marketing, attracting those mid-range or smaller employers that are stressing that great work versus life balance that so many people of us are really trying to achieve?
Kevin, thank you so much. Jerry?
I hope Kevin applies for a job at the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Kevin, your idea about the Census Bureau creating a mid-range, they could have. I think their answer back to you was the whole point of this exercise was to somewhat simplify, because they also removed a second definition of what was urban. So they'd be a little resistant to that. Your other observation, though, about the state stepping in and helping to promote and support these mid-range municipalities is excellent. The reality is that so much of Wisconsin is rural. I mean, I absolutely hate the term flyover state.
Mm.
You know, is this change going to put even more of our places in a forgotten position? You know, do we have to speak a little more loudly to the rest of the country and say, hey, don't forget that these little teeny cities and villages are where a lot of really cool stuff gets made. There's a fabulous work ethic here. In other words, we need to do a better job promoting Wisconsin assets. I think Kevin is absolutely right. While this isn't a major setback, I don't think it'd be fair to say that. I think it's a good reminder that we do need to work harder to tell the rest of the world the Wisconsin story.
Switching gears here now to shared revenue and your take here. I mean, we saw Governor Evers during his reelection campaign calling for increasing state funding of local governments by 10%, that shared revenue program. How much a difference would that hike make for cities and villages?
It, in numbers terms, it would be about $75 million, but in realistic terms, it would in many ways be a lifeline. The way we fund local government in Wisconsin, that system is broken. And the bad news is a number of our municipalities are either headed for or dancing on a fiscal cliff. The good news is the governor's talking about it, the state legislative leaders are talking about it, and there's a lot of interest in fixing it.
How would you update? How would you go about fixing the formula?
It's very simple. What we have suggested to the governor and to legislators is dedicate a penny of the state sales tax. Don't increase it. I want to be real clear on that. But dedicate 1 cent of the 5 cent state sales tax to local government. That would be a significant increase. It would keep police departments funded. It would allow us to shore up our EMS system, which, by the way, is collapsing all over Wisconsin. And furthermore, the most important thing it would do, Kate, is it would link local governments to the economy. Hmm. Right now, the primary funding mechanism that local governments have is the property tax. I think we can all agree that it is overtaxed, no pun intended, but that's all cities and villages and towns and counties have. By linking, basically making a bargain or reestablishing a bargain with the state saying, every year, whatever the sales tax raised, send 20% of that back to local government. And that would become a reliable revenue stream for them. It would also be a stream that's linked to the economy, linked to the local economy, linked to the state economy.
Do you see an appetite with that when you talk with lawmakers and you see what the governor has in mind?
That is the good news, yes. I see an appetite to make a change. Now, I think the governor, you know, everybody's got a little bit different take how they do this. The governor would do it simply by increasing the shared revenue formula. That is one approach. Legislative leaders are more interested in dedicating a portion of the sales tax. That is another approach. Either approach would work. We think the sales tax approach is more sustainable in the long run, but we are absolutely willing to have a conversation and figure out what works best for everyone.
In recent days, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has said, you know, he's open to increasing shared revenue, but first wants local governments to make, quote, meaningful spending reforms and permanent cost-saving measures. Are local officials able to make significant budget cuts?
Well, first of all, local officials have been making what I would have to characterize as drastic budget cuts over the past few years. City of Milwaukee alone has gotten rid of over 1,000 positions. That's a substantial number of employees. The number of local government employees is lower than it's been in decades. The number of police officers on the job in Wisconsin is the lowest it's been on record. And now they haven't been keeping records that long, but that's over a decade. So during a time when people are concerned about public safety, it doesn't make sense for us to be going the other way. We've talked to the speaker, and what the speaker acknowledges that local governments have had to tighten their belts and cut budgets. What the speaker is working with us on is, are there ways to truly innovate, not just cut, but innovate? Are there ways we can work together across city and village borders and share services, do things like that? Quite frankly, it's a very engaging conversation. The devil is in the details because there aren't really good state models for that. Hmm. But we are doing our best and we're confident we'll find something.
Jerry DeShane with us, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, as we talk about how cities and villages are faring. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You know, what about more privatizing or sharing services, like you just mentioned, to help drive down municipal costs? Is that realistic and doable, considering what you see out there as a crisis?
It is realistic and doable, but I want to remind people that in some parts of Wisconsin, we're going to have to spend more money, not less. One of the crises we're looking at right now is because there are fewer young people, fewer people coming into the workforce. Volunteer ambulance services across Wisconsin are quickly becoming unsustainable. There's just no one to drive the ambulance. Those people, whether we like it or not, are going to have to be replaced at least at some level with paid staff, and that's going to cost money. Are there other places where we could consolidate, could share services, share police, share fire, whatever? Absolutely. And I think we owe it to the taxpayer to be looking for those. But I think we have to be very careful that that works in some situations. It is not a one-size-fits-all by any means.
Very quickly, as we're starting to run out of time here, we saw Governor Evers, who met with the mayors of the state's five largest cities. What are smaller cities grappling with that it could be, you know, overlooked by state officials when they're not at the table?
The smaller cities are grappling with exactly the same problem Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay are grappling with. Mm-hmm. The system itself is the problem. It's not a big city, small city, rural, urban. It's not that problem. The problem is the system itself is no longer serving the needs of local governments or their citizens.
Jerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Kate, it's always a pleasure, and I appreciate that you never once made a comparison to me and a troll.
Jerry DeShane, Executive Director of the League of Wisconsin Municipalities, driving it home there. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.